Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. This is your host, Cindy Sheehan, and we're at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today's Soapbox, we're honored to have John Burris, a California attorney who's been a legendary civil rights attorney and champion for those who have been abused by the police state. He wrote a book called Blue versus Black. He was a co-counsel for Rodney King's civil trial against the LAPD. He's Oscar Grant's mother's attorney, Wanda Johnson. And like I said, we're very honored to have him on the show today. John, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Thank you for being on the show.
Good to be with you.
Okay, my first question, of course, you are the attorney for Wanda Johnson, Oscar Grant's mother. And for my listeners who maybe have been in a cave for the past few weeks, can you tell us the significance of Oscar Grant, what happened to him, and what has recently been happening in the news around this issue?
Well, Oscar Grant is an African-American male that was shot and killed by a BART police officer on January 1, 2009. At the time he was shot and killed, Mr. Grant was face down, hands behind his back, and for inexplicable reasons, the officer pulled out his gun and shot him in the back, killing him. This has caused a tremendous amount of outcry in all communities, frankly. It was videotaped by a number of different commuters who were on the train on New Year's night, and they videotaped this. And so we've had a fairly good picture about what took place on that night. Since then, the officer was charged with murder, and the case, after some litigation in Northern California, was moved to Southern California. And very recently, a criminal trial was held in Southern California. And to my great surprise and discomfort and in dismay, he was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter, essentially meaning that he failed to exercise due care, which was a pretty shocking development.
That was a shocking development, but some people have said that verdict, of course, was not just. It was basically a slap on the wrist. But you have been doing this for a long time. Many people said the surprising thing was that he was even brought to trial.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I have been doing this for many, many years, and I've had well over 30 police shooting death cases by police officers, and not one of those cases have I been able to persuade a district attorney or the Justice Department to prosecute the officer. So in this case, we're quite happy that that did occur. There was a lot of political angst around it. He did. And certainly, from my point of view, I would have preferred a verdict that was a little more in recognition of the conduct. I am certainly pleased that there was a verdict of guilty of some kind. At least there was some acknowledgement through the judicial system that the shooting was wrong and unlawful. It did not fairly and accurately state what the facts represent. But in this era of police misconduct and African-American males, it may have been the best that we could have hoped for, even though I wanted more.
Well, certainly. Do you think that he was brought to trial because of the video or because of the community uprising for some kind of justice for Oscar Grant and his family?
Well, I think all of it mattered. You had the video, which had a stark reality of what Mr. Grant was doing, and you have what the police officer did, and on his face, it didn't make any sense as to what caused it, why he did the shooting. Now, of course, that's never the end of the story, because in a homicide case, you have to look to see what was in the person's mind, what was their intent. But certainly the community pressure and the videotape, and the sense that you cannot allow this to take place without some acknowledgement and some accountability, I think all contributed in large measure to the case being brought to trial and perhaps at the end of the day to a conviction.
Yeah.
Now, the next portion of this, of course, is the sentence. And what kind of sentence does he get?
Right.
Because It could really be a slap on the wrist. In fact, if he gets a probation sentence, which is possible given that he was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, you in fact could get probation on a case like that, and that would do a tremendous harm to the overall psyche, certainly the African American community here. And I imagine anybody that has a real sense of what justice is supposed to be and fairness, that they would view that a person should be punished for taking the life of someone under these circumstances.
So do you think that the use of, almost everybody now has a video camera on their cell phone. Do you think that has any chance of keeping police more honest and less violent towards people?
Well, you're right. Number one, everyone has a cell phone with a camera, myself included. And I do think that it has the potential to cut down on violence, and I think it has the potential to cause officers to think twice about using gratuitous force. That is to say, excessive force that need not be used. I don't know that it will have the impact on a shooting case where it's a question of shoot, don't shoot, and an officer uses whatever judgment or lack thereof in shooting. I don't think that when an officer makes that decision, he cares whether there's a camera in front of him or not, generally because in a shoot, don't shoot situation, theoretically, one is supposed to have their life in danger. What the camera does show, if your life wasn't in danger, then you could be exposed, like in this case, for having fabricated a defense. In the Measurely case, even though the camera was there, he didn't know the camera was there at the time he gave his initial statements to the police over the first several days, whether he thought Oscar Grant was going for something. It wasn't until the video surfaced that he ultimately, through defense, changed that story. But I think if individual officers know that there's a video camera present at all times, they'll be less inclined to fabricate a story and maybe less inclined to use excessive force, particularly of the physical nature where it goes to use of taser, batons, etc.
Well, that definitely is a police state tactic. They even use it in battle zones where innocent civilians are killed. They accuse them of they thought they had a weapon, or they caught them with a shovel and they were going to bury a bomb or something. So that is a police state tactic, and hopefully we can become citizen vigilantes for peace and for justice by appropriately using our cell phones in those cases to keep the police state more honest. But let's talk about in your book, Blue versus Black.
You got it right. My book, Blue versus Black, Let's End the Conflict Between Cops and Minorities, is a book that at the time, now it's a while ago, that was certainly my sense about policing at the time. I had been involved in the Rodney King case down in Los Angeles, and I was particularly struck by the fact that one or more of those officers that were involved in the Rodney King beating seemed to be pretty decent people. And I just wondered how it was that these officers, but one or two, particularly Timothy Wynn, could engage in this act of brutality when everything about him was that of a decent young man, and he wanted to be a police officer, had left his home in Kansas. And so I wanted to know more about that. And so I also had a number of individuals who had been severely beaten by the police. Rodney King was just one. And so I wanted to talk about policing community, this conflict that existed within the African-American community with the police and police culture itself. And, the code of silence, the commitment to each other, the brotherhood or sisterhood, if you will, that can really obscure a police officer's judgment. And so I did have a lot of stories, and I had accumulated a lot of data. But I wanted to, at the end of the day, be positive about all of this. And so what I did was come forward with sort of a 10-point plan that I thought was important, and that was to look, I can't recite them all, but look at training. One, look at how police officers are hired, where they come from, what their experiences are, what kind of training you want to give them, the kind of training that allows them to be responsive to the community in which they serve, to get rid of some of the stereotypic notions they have about people in their communities, and then to go internally into the department to see how are they holding their supervisors accountable. And what are they doing about people who, in fact, get claims of excessive force against them? Are these people being promoted or not? And what I saw is that there were cliques within the department, very strong cliques. And how you performed and related to that clique pretty much could determine how you got promoted. And if you didn't perform well or wasn't brought into the clique, you could not get promoted, and you could get lousy assignments, and you didn't move along. In a police department, rank is everything. Assignments are important. The kind of assignments you get, the amount of overtime you get, how fast you move up from sergeant to lieutenant to captain, these are extraordinarily important items for police officers because their pension is a function of that. And the higher your salary, the more money you make, the better it is for your pension. And so your relationships that you have within those departments can determine how fast you move up. So I wanted to discuss those issues and really then ultimately get to the point of how can we improve the quality of policing. And for me, I had a unique opportunity after that, after I finished the book, Dennis Case in Oakland developed called The Writers. And it allowed me to make a huge impact on that department. We got what they call a negotiated settlement agreement that put the case under federal monitor, federal judicial control with independent monitors, and myself and my co-counsel, Jim Channon, remained in the case. And we've been involved in that case for a number of years. It just so happens yesterday we settled another case against the city of Oakland where there was a violation of the search warrant policy there, and a number of people had been injured there as well. So my book itself serves as the underpinning for me to have a firm understanding of police agencies and to allow me to be in a position to improve them when that opportunity presented itself.
Well, there has been, of course, for forever in this country, there's been blue versus black problems, but it's not really a racial thing. You didn't write the book called White versus Black. Is it more of a police kind of thing?
No, it was not a racial. It's not a race book at all. It was not intended to be a race book. It was about police and their policing of a community. Whatever that community is. And so what I wanted to illustrate, the culture of policing, but more importantly, I wanted to put forth a blueprint in my view of how to go forward in policing. I think policing is obviously communities need them. You just want them to be people who respect the constitutional rights of individuals. We know that bad people have to be arrested, but that doesn't mean you have to beat them up. We know that innocent people get beat up and arrested, and that should not occur. We know that Oscar Grant got shot and killed because of excessive force. That should have never happened. There were other people in that platform that got roughed up. That should have never happened. But it occurred as a consequence of a police officer named Anthony Peroni being overly aggressive that evening. And so an over-aggressive police officer can cause a lot of harm in a community and can cause situations to get out of control. So my book was to discuss some of those issues, and that's what I tried to do, to enlighten not only the police to the other side of things, but also the community itself. And at the time, I was a strong proponent of sort of citizen review boards and how important it was for the citizen to have a place to go, a complainant, if you will. It doesn't have to be a citizen. Somebody who has a complaint against a police officer should have a place to go and have that heard to an independent or neutral body. And so I wanted to explore, and I did not want to. I explored a lot of those issues.
Well, you know, I am from suburban California my whole life, born in Los Angeles, raised in the suburbs, up here in the suburbs of San Francisco. Now I live in Oakland myself. But, you know, the whole time I'm obviously not black or brown. And, you know, growing up, I grew up during the Watts riots, the Rodney King, you know, that uprising. And, you know, I could recognize that the people in those communities were oppressed by the system for a long, long time. But I never, ever was anybody to get in trouble with the law. But now, since my son was killed and I go and I do acts of civil resistance, I have been arrested like 15 or 16 times now. I have gone to jail, and I have witnessed with my own eyes how every time something like that has happened, it's been the police that have caused the breach of peace, not the citizens. So many times their actions are what stimulate violence or overreaction. Do you find this to be the case?
Well, no doubt about that. The Oscar Grant case is a classic example of that. I was in a case in Oakland several years ago where protesters were protesting the Iraq war over at the Port of Oakland. And ultimately, a lot of misconduct took place by the police, but it was the police who caused the problem. They were the ones that were engaged in the overly aggressive, riotous behavior. And as a consequence of that, we were able to develop a policy, rewrite the policy based upon a lawsuit that allowed us to rewrite the policy, crowd control policy, and so we've been very fortunate to have that implemented here in Oakland for the last few times. And I dare say that it even worked the other night when we had the riotous behavior that took place after the Oscar Grant verdict, because in that situation, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And it has been on other occasions. There were people there who were hell-bent on creating a problem. There's not much you can ever do about them. But on balance, I really didn't think the police overreacted too much.
Well, that's really nice to hear. What do you think about the community of Oakland laying off 200 police officers?
Well, from what I gather, it's 80. And it strikes me as a political misstep or political decisions that took place. Actually, it's a political conflict between the union, police union and the city council. The police union want more concessions. The city wants concessions from the police union, and the union doesn't want to give up the concessions. And so I view that not as a political fight between them, in large measure because the union has here in Oakland has a tremendous contract, a lot of benefits. And they don't want to give up any of those benefits, and they want more. So I'm always suspicious when the union is involved because they have a lot of benefits. And like a lot of cities, the law enforcement, public safety officers hold people hostage, hold the city hostage. They take over a huge chunk of the budget, and whatever they get, they want to keep. So I'm not overly overly impressed by this. I think essentially this sounds like that this is a political fight that's taking place, and at some point in time it get resolved like political fights do, and that is through a political compromise. If not, that means that someone didn't keep their eye on the ball, and they were more interested in their own particular agenda and less about the public agenda.
Well, in the last few minutes we have, and you know, I hope that we can touch base with you again sometime in the future because you know, your resume and your history is quite impressive, and you have a lot of stories to tell, I'm sure. But in the last few minutes, I just really, as a mother whose son was killed, I'd like to know how Oscar Grant's mother, Wanda, is doing, and has there been a civil suit filed against
Yes, I'm involved in a civil suit with her. I represent the family in a civil suit. We're presently in federal court here in a civil rights case of excessive force, essentially alleging that, one, a taser shouldn't have been used, but obviously if the firearm was used, that shouldn't have been used either. And so we have that. Now, and in terms of how she's doing, she's a lady that you understand what pain is like when you can't offer a reasonable explanation for it.
Yeah.
And so she cries a lot. She suffers a lot. And when we were in the trial, the criminal trial, there were times when emotionally she just had that deep, and you can appreciate this, deep, painful sob that no one can feel and understand but a mother who's lost their child. And so your heart has to go out to her. And to see it manifest in ways where her son was placed in a very negative light by the defense, who tried to demonize him, that was very hurtful to her. And so as a mother, she's had a hard time appreciating the legal niceties and the machinery of the system. And certainly my job is to try to help her get through all of that, which I'm trying to do.
Oh, it must be. I mean, I know the pain of just waking up in the morning knowing that you buried a child, but to go through these struggles and, you know, just let her know that we appreciate it. All of my listeners, our hearts do go out to her. But it's a struggle not just for her family, but it's a struggle for everybody. And Oscar is gone. We can't bring him back, but we can try and make meaning out of his death and make something positive come out of it.
No, so she's down. She's for that, too. And I'm for that. And, you know, unfortunately, I've, and you know this as well, out of every tragedy, it presents an opportunity. And it's really up to those of us who remain here to appreciate the tragedy and turn that tragedy into something positive that increases the benefit for others and hopefully prevent it from happening to others. But at least says that we're not going to take it. We don't accept the official position, that often the official position is not a true and accurate position, and we do what we can to fight it. And I think she's doing exactly that by standing up for her son.
And we wish her all strength, and you also. And thank you for your work, and thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today, John.
Glad to be here. You take care. You keep up the good work you're doing. I appreciate it.
Oh, great. We'll talk to you soon, I hope. Well, thank you for listening to our Soapbox interview with John Burris. And as always, I'd like to thank Scott, my engineer, Mikey, my producer, Rich, my webmaster, you for listening, our guest, John Burris. And we're going to close the show today with an audio extraction from a YouTube video. And it's about a little over 6 minutes of Barack Obama lying during the campaign about bringing our troops home from Iraq. So give it a listen, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you for listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan.
When I listen to mothers and fathers all across the country, they are telling me it's time for us to come home. I'm proud of the fact that I put forward a plan in January that mirrors what Congress ultimately adopted. And it says there's no military solution to this. We've got to have a political solution, begin a phased withdrawal, and make certain that we've got benchmarks in place so that the Iraqi people can make a determination about how they want to move forward.
How do we pull out now?
Senator Obama, how do we pull out now?
Look, I opposed this war from the start because I anticipated that we would be creating the kind of sectarian violence that we've seen and that it would distract us from the war on terror,
right, so
that was necessary. I'm going to get to the question, Anderson. At this point, I think we can be as careful getting out as we were careless getting in. But we have to send a clear message to the Iraqi government as well as to the surrounding neighbors that there is no military solution to the problems that we face in Iraq. We just heard a White House spokesman, Tony Snow, excuse the fact that the Iraqi legislature went on vacation for 3 weeks because it's hot in Baghdad. Well, let me tell you, it is hot for American troops who are over there with 100 pounds worth of gear, and that kind of irresponsibility is not helpful. So we have to begin a phased withdrawal, have our combat troops out by March 31st of next year, and initiate the kind of diplomatic surge that is necessary in the surrounding region to make sure that everybody is carrying their weight. And that is what I will do on day one as President of the United States if we have not done it in the intervening months.
As President, I want us to fight on the right battlefield. And what that means is getting out of Iraq and refocusing our attention on the war that can be won in Afghanistan. And that also will allow us to free up the kinds of resources that will make us safer here at home, because we'll be able to invest in port security, chemical plant security, all the critical issues that have already been discussed.
Pertaining to the subject of the votes and the authorization, Senator Obama, this is a question I've been meaning to ask you since, I guess, the night this occurred. Why did it take so long to hear how you were going to vote on the subject of that war supplemental on May 24th? We didn't learn until that evening when you actually cast your vote. Why is that the case?
Well, because the fact is that, you know, it is difficult to send a message to the president who has been so obstinate for so long. All of us on this stage want to make sure that our troops are funded. And all of us believe that we need to be orderly and careful in bringing them out. My hope was that we would start seeing some progress among the Republicans where they would begin to agree with us on a timetable to withdraw. We have convinced some people, including some folks on this stage, that this was a mistake and that it was important for us to start drawing troops down. But apparently we have not convinced enough Republicans. And at that point, it was my belief that the only way we could send a strong signal to the president to make sure that he came back to the table was to vote no on that supplemental. But understand this, Keith, unless we can change the minds of some additional Republicans who are responsible for continuing to hand the keys of the car to the president on this issue, we are going to have to wait until I am president of the United States. And when I do, I promise you my first act will be calling together the Joint Chiefs of Staff and give them a mission to bring our troops home so that we can start stabilizing Iraq, but also focus on the war on terrorism that's out there right now.
Thank you, sir.
If we have not begun a withdrawal by the time I'm sworn into office, then the next task is to call together the Joint Chiefs of Staff and to give them the mission, which is to begin a orderly phased withdrawal so that we can begin the diplomacy that Joe and Bill and others are talking about.
You know, I'm happy to have this discussion again, Bill. I think it is important to tell the American people the truth. Now, military commanders indicate that they can safely get combat troops out at a pace of 1 to 2 brigades a month. That is the quickest pace that we can do it safely. And I've said I will begin immediately, and we will do it as rapidly as we can. The overall strategy is failed because we have not seen any change in behavior among Iraq's political leaders. And that is the essence of what we should be trying to do in Iraq. That's why I'm going to bring this war to a close. That's why we can get our troops out, our combat troops out, within 16 months. So the notion that somehow because we've gone from horrific violence to just intolerable levels of violence, and that somehow that justifies George Bush's strategy, is absolutely wrong, and I'm going to bring it to a halt when I'm president of the United States.
Thank you, Senator.
Remember, we were in New Hampshire together, and I asked the three of you if you would pledge to have all troops out of Iraq by the end of your first term. All three of you said, we will not take that pledge. I'm hearing something much different tonight.
I want to make sure. I think this is important because it was reported as if we were suggesting that we would continue a war until 2013. Your question was, could I guarantee all troops would be out of Iraq? I have been very specific in saying that we will not have permanent bases there. I will end the war as we understand it in combat missions.
Senator Obama?
John, what I've said, and I've said repeatedly, is I want to be as careful getting out as we were careless getting in, but I want to make sure that we get all our combat troops out as quickly as we can safely. Now, the estimates are maybe that's 2 brigades per month. At that pace, it would be sometime in 2009.
Give us some sense of when you might start redeployments out of Iraq.
Well, I've said during the campaign, and I stick to this commitment, that as soon as I take office, I will call in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, my national security apparatus, and we will start executing a plan that draws down our troops.
I must make my witness. I have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.